Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life.
Welcome, listener, to the Gravity Commons Podcast. My name is Matt Tebbe. This is my voice with a slight cold in the middle of winter, and I'm joined by my friend Ben Sternke.
Hi there. This is my voice without a cold in the middle of winter. I don't think I have a cold. I feel pretty good.
We're podcasting today without our friend Christy, who is, she's busy. She's got a job. She's got a family. She has other interests outside of the Commons Podcast.
Yeah. Unlike Matt and I.
No, we have no life.
No jobs. No families.
Sometimes I get on Riverside, which is the website we record, and I just talk to myself. Mm-hmm. Practicing just, for this moment, yep. Which means I should have something more profound or maybe erudite to say, but I don't.
It's too bad. Joking, all joking aside,
we are continuing our series here on evangelicalism. But before I do, I just want to let listener know that we pull together Gravity Formation courses hither and yon. Mm-hmm. Based upon interest, and there is a renewed spark of interest here in the new year. And so if you have thought about the Gravity Formation course in the past, want to know more about it, have questions about it, or maybe have felt compelled or convicted that it would be good for you and just haven't acted on that, pulled the trigger, clicked the link, maybe is a better apt way to say that. Yes. I just invite you to reach out. You can message me at matt@gravitycommons.com. And I've got a few more places or spaces in this cohort I'm pulling together. And I'd love to chat with you more about what it is and if it's a good fit to see if we can make something happen.
Yeah. Yeah, there's information about that on our website. It's pretty easy to find. But yeah, the best way to probably just to email Matt. You're not making a commitment by doing that. Matt just likes to talk to people.
It would be a improvement over talking to myself here on Riverside.
Yeah. You're a lot more extroverted than I am, Matt.
That's what
I notice.
That's Ben, if I can correct you. Okay. I am an ambivert, but I am an external processor. Yeah. I need to verbalize my thoughts to know what I'm thinking and also to put them together, which has made working by myself the last 10 years really hard.
Yeah.
So I had this realization in a conversation we were having with some friends about I'm pretty active on Facebook, and Facebook is doing all kinds of wackadoodle things with fact-checking or not fact-checking. And we were having a conversation, Ben, you were there, among friends about how and when do we leave social media platforms, and what's sort of the governing or guiding virtue or value or rubric do we use to like decide, right? I'm going to support this entity, this corporation, by letting them make advertising dollars off of my content, for instance, or I'm not, you know, and how do we decide that? And I'm much more active on Facebook than the rest of our friends, but I realized this, that I began to use Facebook more when I worked by myself to think out loud. Like, my wife doesn't give two rips about neoliberal finance-driven late modern capitalism.
Right.
She doesn't want to hear anything about that.
At least not she doesn't want to discuss it as a concept.
Right.
But obviously, it affects all of us. But you know what I mean? Like that. That's what you're saying.
Right. So if I verbally process with her, it exacerbates my wife. And I'm told not to exacerbate my kids in scripture. And I'm also going to go ahead and apply that to my spouse.
That's probably a good interpretive. That's a good hermeneutic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. If it's not good for the... If it's not good for the gander, I'm not doing it to the goose either.
Yep.
So I found sort of a way of getting thoughts out of my mind into a space and then having some sort of interaction or conversation about them. I found that to be like vital, crucial for me.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I don't know what I think. And thoughts in my ADHD brain kind of create feedback. Like, they build up, and then I have to, like, it's an obstruction to other thoughts. And I've got to get them out It's cleansing. It's a prefrontal cortex cleanse.
Yeah, a Facebook cleanse, social media cleanse, but not like you think. Like most of the time people would think, oh, that means I'm going to get off social media. No, that means Matt gets on like for 12-hour stints, just a Facebook cleanse. Here's all my thoughts.
Yes. Yeah. So I binge and purge the information. it's very healthy, I've decided.
Yeah, that's a good thing.
No, I just realized that in our conversation a couple days ago, Ben, that I am less of an extrovert and more of an external processor.
Mm-hmm.
And I maybe would prefer to do that with just one person,
mm-hmm.
but that person doesn't exist, so I do it into the virtual.
Into the virtual world.
World.
Yeah, I think it's also the reason, I mean, we started this podcast, I think at your prompting.
Behest.
Behest. And I think, you know, it's one of the reasons that I think you think of, you know, producing content in this way, maybe more readily than I do or others do. Because just to be clear, like, I think you're using the definition of extrovert as somebody who gains energy by being around people.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're solar powered, whereas like introverts are battery powered.
Right.
That's the metaphor that I've heard. But that's different than processing out loud. Because I resonate with that too, that I do tend, my thinking does get clarified when I can process out loud with somebody. But I don't need to do it as often as I don't know. I've never really thought about whether I'm an internal or an external processor. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm an ambiprocessor or something, because there are times where I really enjoy like a really long time by myself.
Yes.
And it does clarify my thinking. I can journal, I can outline, you know, I can figure something out, and I like writing typically more than I like speaking off the cuff.
Yes, that's what I was going to point out. Yeah. I think you can externally process, Ben.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're a stronger communicator when you don't.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? Like you can do generative, constructive, external processing, but your strength is when you have time to reflect and then express and then edit and then refine.
Right.
You know, I've joked about this with you that you have like the gift of emails,
mm-hmm.
and your writing is more, I think, traditional writing, meaning, you know, longer form paragraphs, right? Subject, mm-hmm. argument, resolution, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas for me, when I write, I have to more closely approximate my speech pattern in order for it to feel not more authentic, sounds you know, kind of gross, but more closely aligned, like less of a chore.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's
so interesting. Yeah, it is interesting. So I think that podcasting off the cuff or doing things like this is takes less. It's less work for me. I don't have to work at it. You know, maybe I should do a little more work. But.
all play, no work. No, yeah, that makes sense. How do we get on the subject? I can't even remember.
Well, I don't quite remember how we got on the subject, but we are continuing to discuss something I wrote, which we might not even get to today. I don't know.
The topic is, you're right, leaving evangelicalism, which is the post that you wrote.
Yeah, the post that I wrote. I'm trying to get to a place where what I wrote has context and makes sense, right?
Yeah.
So what did we talk about last time?
I don't remember. No, I'm just kidding. I remember some of it. So there was, we did talk about, I mean, the post that you wrote sort of names a definitive shift in terms of I'm leaving this thing that I used to identify with,
mm-hmm.
In an intentional way, rather than being a, you know, trying to be a prophetic voice from within it or identifying myself with it, but trying to reform it or, you know, that kind of a thing. And I think that's an interesting shift because it does have to do with, you know, I mean, it wasn't like you got kicked out of a commune or, you know what I mean? Like there's, mm-hmm. you know, the form of belonging. I mean, we did, you know, move denominations. That was part of the significant part of this for me as well, obviously.
Right.
But yeah, that shift in identity is significant. And I think this post and this series is just us reflecting on that and saying, well, what brought about this shift in identity? What have we learned about evangelicalism that maybe we were naive about earlier? Mm-hmm. And last time we talked about the kind of the traditional definition of evangelicalism is a theological definition, something called the Bebbington Quadrilateral.
Yes.
Named after David. Is David Bebbington? I feel like it's David. Mm-hmm. Named after the guy who observed this as a theological trend or a theological, what am I trying to say? It's just like a group of people who seem to have these common commitments.
Yeah.
Right? To, you know, we talked about them last time. But some of what we discovered about the history, that's a theological definition of evangelicalism, but there's a history that is also social and cultural mm-hmm. about how this movement called evangelicalism arose. And we want to talk about why that matters.
Yeah.
For evangelicalism.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I just realized, Ben, that the answer why, and so the title of the article is Why I Left Evangelicalism and Why It Left Me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think trying to unpack, we started with what is evangelicalism. And the reason mm-hmm. we're doing that is because I think I was wrong about what evangelicalism is.
Yeah.
Because I think the story evangelicalism tells about itself isn't true.
Mm-hmm. Or at least hides some of the social cultural reasons that it emerged.
Yeah, and we'll get into that more today. Mm-hmm. But what was happening was the story I was told and believed and, you know, fully propagated for decades.
Mm-hmm.
Increasingly, I had data that didn't fit in with that story.
Right.
There kept being these outliers, these minority reports, that stuff that didn't fit. You know, mm-hmm. Jar Jar Binks. Oh. Kept showing up on the deck of the USS Enterprise. And I had to like try to figure out why.
Yeah.
How did you get here?
Yeah.
You were a bad idea in your own universe, let alone this one.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
And listener, if you're not a sci-fi fan, just those are two things that don't match. Anyway.
So anyway, we've chatted about this for close to a decade. And you recently found an article.
Yeah,
that I think epitomizes or is a quintessential example of how the story evangelicals tell about themselves, which is it's primarily a theological movement mm-hmm. throughout U.S. and Western history that is tied to these theological commitments, the Bebbington Quadrilateral. This article that you found sort of is a great example about how that doesn't quite work.
Yeah. The description, this is from the Washington Post, and we'll put a link to this in the show notes if you're interested. It's from this past summer. It was written in June. And the title is actually that Trump has changed what it means to be evangelical. And so I think the title of the article is a slightly different take than I think what you're talking about, Matt. That perhaps Trump revealed a lot of what it means to be evangelical. But
yeah, this
anyway,
is the... This is the debate. This is the contention.
Right. Did Trump change this? Is this a term that was co-opted by, you know, right-wing politics to use a shorthand term? Was this a term that was co-opted by them, or is something more fundamental going on here? But anyway, this article was astonishing in no matter how you think about this coming about, because. Essentially, the argument of the article is that evangelicalism is really not about theology anymore. It's become about shared political convictions. This is a quote from the article. In one survey of Christian attitudes, for example, 43% of evangelicals
said they did not believe in the divinity of Christ, right? Which goes directly against that Bebbington Quadrilateral. Mm-hmm. So there are these people who say, yes, I'm an evangelical, who probably have no idea what the Bebbington Quadrilateral is, and it's not a theological description of themselves at all. But it gets more bizarre. This is another quote from the article. According to the 2022 Cooperative Election Study, 14% of Muslims and 12% of Hindus and 5% of Jews described themselves as born-again or evangelical Christians. This is not a joke. That's also in the article. This is not a joke. So there are Muslims and Hindus and Jews, a small percentage, but some of them who describe themselves as born-again Christians, evangelical Christians. So the term, again, the argument of the article is that it's changed from what it used to be. And we're talking about like the, or does it reveal what it is? It's just become about these shared political convictions that people, you know, they want to identify as born again or evangelical, even though like they have zero of the theological commitments that traditionally are associated with evangelicalism.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
That is fascinating.
We'll be right back.
Respero. Hey, we've talked about them before. They're an organization that offers faith-based counselor training. They believe that the aim of counseling is real transformation, not just symptom management or removal. Their counselor training courses equip you to help people to be great lovers of others, to understand why they do what they do, to be emotionally healthy, and to live out their identity as someone deeply loved and delighted in by God. All their training is rooted in the belief that Jesus is the source of life and that we can be a part of his work of healing and restoration.
And for pastors and ministry leaders, their training is a proven way to identify the people in your church who might be gifted for lay counseling, and it can be a powerful way to help make your church into a genuine healing community. They provide all the training and the supervision that allows your leaders to do great work and to free up pastoral staff from needing to do all the pastoral counseling in your church. If you are interested, you can go to respero.org, that's R-E-S-P-E-R-O.org, and click on the counselor training tab.
The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, a 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life God shares with us. It's a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying new practices. In the Gravity Formation Course, we go below the surface of our lives so that we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence, and to discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us towards holistic flourishing, more transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people all over the world in this formation framework, and it has helped many people to have a sense of God at work in their lives, to learn how to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation.
Let's get back to the show. You know, and I think the standard line of sort of the accepted standard mantra about that from inside the brand or inside the institution of evangelicalism is those people aren't real evangelicals. That 43%.
Right.
They aren't really us. They think they're us, but they're not.
Yeah.
And this go ahead.
Trump co-opted the term and the voting block, and now people who really want to associate themselves with right-wing politics, what they want to do is claim that term because it's come to mean that.
Yes, they seduced the brethren, right, away, which was kind of the thesis of the book, The Kingdom and the Power and the Glory, that we read by Tim Alberta, right? This was his thesis that he kept stating over and over was that there is this seduction into politics, into right-wing MAGA that has overtaken the church and people like Russell Moore and David French and others are working hard to disciple evangelicals so they can reject MAGA. Right.
Yeah. So the answer to this, you know, 43% of evangelicals say they don't believe in the divinity of Christ. The answer is to teach them about the divinity of Christ.
Yes.
Because they don't know it and they've become, you know, and so the answer is discipleship.
Right. You
know, at least in those terms, like theological education.
It's just education, theological education. Yeah. Here's a good pivot. Because the article that we posted in the show notes last time, which we can also link this time, the title of it being Redefining the History and Historiography on American Evangelicalism in the Era of the Religious Right by Matthew Avery Sutton. It's the what's going on today, 2016 to today, is the same move that evangelicals did in the late 70s and early 80s in response to the rise of the religious right. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating to me, and I'd love to share a little bit about this article, if I can.
I'll allow it.
Thanks, Ben. Thanks. Let me get my get my papers in order here.
Mm-hmm. The timer has started.
Okay, so Sutton argues that the intelligentsia of evangelical historians, Randy Balmer, Mark Knoll, Mardson, Nathan Hatch, people that are well-known who've worked at Notre Dame and Wheaton and other places, that just before and during the rise of the religious right, that these conservative religious self-identified evangelical historians were offended and bothered by what they saw as the partisan politicization of white evangelical people. And so they went looking in history to reclaim an evangelical identity that was distinct from and more essential than socio-cultural political commitments. So almost the same move as we're seeing today from guys like Russell Moore and David French, right? Mm-hmm. Except they were saying this about Pat Robertson and James Dobson. Like they were saying essentially, you have co-opted this beautiful historical theological consensus that we call evangelicalism, and you are perverting it by leveraging it or by subsuming it under a political partisan moniker.
Yeah. So the argument essentially, and he's a historian, the argument essentially, my understanding of, I haven't read the full article, but the argument essentially, my understanding of it is that he says that it's not good history that they've done. So instead of focusing on the specific historical, cultural, political context from which this emerged, they defined it as a set of abstract theological principles and then used those principles as a lens to go back in history to find people that fit, that seem to fit this theological principle like as a lens, and who made positive contributions to North American history, and they tried to define this is a movement that's been focused on these theological principles, and it seems like his argument is that's actually not very good history because they've constructed a lens that they want to look for, and then they just go look for examples of people through that lens, and they say this is a movement, but it has to ignore the actual political, cultural, historical context from which evangelicalism emerged in order to tell that story. And so his argument is basically like, it's not good history. It's not a good way to do history.
Yes. It's very selective and it's designed to extricate or exonerate conservative Christians from being primarily, centrally, substantially a socio-cultural movement. Mm-hmm. Here's a quote. These historians underplayed how post-World War II evangelicalism is at its heart a political movement. Rather than explain how evangelicalism became a powerful and effective partner for the Republican right, they instead claimed that a, quote, true evangelicalism existed separate from its political manifestations. Yes. And so they did this in a variety of ways. They, you know, and this is the story of evangelicalism, the one that Nolan, Martson, and Hatch and others tell. This is the one that I had been pre-MAGA. And it's that evangelicals are the inheritors of the democratic freedom, justice-seeking movement that funded and fomented the American Revolution, breaking free of sort of oppressive hierarchies and stale clericism, those kinds of things.
Yeah,
and it grabbed hold of the entire country during the first and second Great Awakenings, mm-hmm. before and after the American Revolution.
Right? Yeah, yeah,
and then it propelled social progress through the 19th century, right? So mm-hmm. abolitionists of slavery were Christians. Right. Yep. William Wilberforce, if you've heard his name once, you've heard it a million times. Mm-hmm. It spurred on the social progress of like sort of egalitarian notions of equality for women and other things like that.
Yeah.
Eventually, this great tradition, this great history, this great stream was polluted or perverted with the religious right.
Right, in the 80s. And then the same kind of story, like to bring it back all the way to the beginning of what we were talking about.
Yeah.
Then the same kind of story is told then in 2016 when we're like, wait, why did 81% of evangelicals vote for Trump?
Right.
What's going
on? Right. And in this article, Sutton points out some of the more devastating problems with this. You mentioned already, like abstracting history from historical particulars. Like, there was no common consciousness of evangelicalism until the 50s, mm-hmm. with the invention of the National Association of Evangelicals by a couple fundamentalist guys who wanted to get equal opportunity with the FCC. That what they saw mainline, socially progressive, even, you know, this is part of the Red Scare, right? So even like what they thought was communist-leaning, mainline liberal people, they wanted equal representation. So they created an association that would give some kind of political heft in mm-hmm. the public square mm-hmm. so that... conservative religious voices, which were called fundamentalists at the time, would have an equal playing field, equal opportunity, right? Yeah. Yeah. There was a diversity of little sectarian, discrete movements, religious movements that actually didn't like each other. You know, they didn't see themselves as a collective or as one identity. Mm-hmm. Their telling of history also vastly underplays the evangelical contributions and complicity in slavery.
Yeah.
You know, they focus mostly on the North, mm-hmm. and many of the Northern abolitionist sort of impulses in the 19th century were more socially progressive people that would not at all identify with a early 21st century white evangelical.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's interesting because I think, and maybe we're getting ahead of ourselves but with this question, but maybe we're not, because I think, like, the question I have, and the question I've heard from a lot of people who still do identify very strongly as evangelicals, like a friend of mine, for example, I remember we were talking about sort of discovering, I think we were reading about abortion, and, you know, one of the things that was shocking to me was learning that abortion used to be in the 70s, even among so-called evangelicals, a controversial and a complex issue.
Yeah.
There was not a firm, like,
pro-life kind of stance that every evangelical had. It wasn't a strong, it wasn't as strongly associated with evangelicals as it is today. And I was just shocked to find that out, that it became an issue after essentially the religious right learned that it could, you know, be used as a, you know, as a way to galvanize a voting block, essentially.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the comment that I made in this conversation was it was never about the babies, you know, it was about political power. But this person, who again, still identifies as an evangelical, she said to me, she's like, but it always was about the babies for me.
Yes.
It is about the babies for me.
Yes.
You know, I have to honor that. It's like, well, of course it was, you know, and I resonate with that. It's like, well, yeah, I wasn't going for political power, you know, mm-hmm. like when I identified as an evangelical, I wasn't like secretly racist in that, you know, in that way that we oftentimes think about racism. So I wonder what you would say to somebody who does identify with the Bebbington Quadrilateral and says, well, what, like, you know, does that, what does it mean for me? If it's about the babies for me, or if I really want, you know, to identify as an evangelical, what does it mean for me?
Yeah.
If I do, for me, it is theological.
You know? Yeah. I think there's two main responses that I've seen. And one is to then do kind of what I think these historians were doing in the 80s, which is try to differentiate a remnant or a faithful contingent of people mm-hmm. over and against those who are perverting what we believe.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So yeah. Nolan, Martzen, and Hatch and the rest of them, I think it was a noble activity, even if it was misguided historiography.
Yeah.
They were seeking to oppose what they saw was an unfaithful embodiment of what they believed.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So I do think there are some people who are pro-life that are attempting to do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have somebody on social media who's a well-known proponent of being pro-life. When Roe v. Wade was struck down, this is not somebody who considers abortion to be the only place that we need to be concerned about life. And so...
Right.
Their social media post, their article was, we spent 40 years seeking to overturn this ruling, 45. Now we can turn our attention in the pro-life movement to all these other life concerns, you know, and
poverty, and for example, right?
Poverty, death
penalty,
housing, yeah. healthcare. All these yeah. things. Yeah. And so I see this person as attempting to do this move.
Yeah.
To hold their people accountable to the rhetoric they use and make good on it.
Mm-hmm.
My yeah. observation is that is ineffective
mm-hmm.
and doesn't work.
Yeah.
I mean, you can look at the people who gave the most money to the pro-life movement, who are most vocal about the pro-life movement. Just look at their records since abortion was struck down and see if they have done anything about those concerns.
Yeah, the wider pro-life concerns.
Probably. They haven't. They haven't. Yeah. So I think what I would tell that person is, look, if that's you, And you want to see this, look and see who the people you've entrusted to tell you the truth about abortion, look and see what they're doing now.
Mm-hmm.
And let's have an honest reckoning about, is it about life?
Yeah.
Or is it about
yeah.
partisan power?
And I think this is the crux of the issue then, because if you look at this broad movement, that's called evangelicalism, and this is what your post is about. And you do have this deep theological commitment to life, for example, to use that as an example.
Yeah.
But these people that said they told you that they shared that commitment, if they are revealing that they do not, as a group, right? There's probably pockets of people who do.
Mm-hmm.
Then, like, what would be the best thing for you to do is to maybe go in search of people who do share your commitments, you know, or at least who share them a bit more.
Yeah.
Right. Than these people. Right.
Yeah, that's the first thing. The second thing, though, that I think was helpful to me mm-hmm. is to reevaluate my commitments. That's not to say that I go from being pro-life to anti-life.
Right.
But like, if these people aren't doing what I thought they would do mm-hmm. or what they said they would do, yeah. can I trust the things I learned from them?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So then for me, it was we're getting really in the weeds here, but it was reevaluating the story and the ethical architecture and the moral universe that I imbibed, that I appropriated from them about abortion.
Right.
Like, yeah. okay, if I can't trust you to have a consistent ethic of life and to care about all of life as much as you care about the unborn.
Right.
Then I need to reevaluate what I thought I trusted you with about the unborn.
Yeah. Yeah, that theological commitment then, like you have to rethink, wait, how does this theological commitment to life, for example, how does that actually play out in relationship to the unborn or the, you know, to the issue of abortion? How does it actually play out in real life? And then, yeah, just reevaluating the stories that we've been told about how it's supposed to, how it's always, you know, like faithful evangelical Christians have always believed this. And it's like, well, they haven't, you know what I mean? Like this story was created and it is, yeah, there's a reckoning that has to happen with those theological yeah. commitments.
Yeah.
And how they live themselves out.
Yeah. And so maybe to tie off this little rabbit trail, if you're curious about what an exploration of that looks like with a commitment to the scriptures and a commitment to what we all consider evangelical commitments, we did a podcast with Mako Nagasawa about this. Mm-hmm. And you can search up that, just search abortion and Nagasawa, Nagasawa, lots mm-hmm. of A's. And you can find that conversation. His book is great on that as well. But so that's, so I would just say, like, we have, it's, and this is one of the reasons why I talk about, like, normalizing being wrong. It's embarrassing to believe people who lie to you.
Yeah.
And to be duped or yeah. to be suckered or to be swindled, mm-hmm. Boondoggled, it's bamboozled. It's really embarrassing. It's yeah. embarrassing.
Yeah.
There's shame there, right?
Yes. Yes.
So the veracity or the truthfulness of your belief, like my belief, like what I had to reckon with is I was believing weaponized propaganda mm-hmm. that preyed upon my good intention and pure motives that ended up being misinformation and disinformation that used morality for immoral purposes.
Yeah.
Which is, frankly, I almost vomit as I just say that, you know. Mm-hmm. It's awful.
And now, a word from a sponsor. All right, let's get back into our conversation.
I think that's important to name, that there is shame and yeah. embarrassment.
Yeah.
That also rises up in us that makes it difficult to really reckon with these things. And that's there's nothing wrong with you that you feel embarrassed. Like, there's actually probably something right with you that you feel embarrassed. Mm-hmm. You know, and it is a sign that you have a conscience. Mm. And it's a sign that you really do care about the things that you claim to care about.
Yes.
So I think it's a good thing. And if we can name it as, okay, I feel ashamed of this. If we can name it as such, it's like, okay, well now I can reckon with that too. That reason that I might be maybe not quite going there in my mind in terms of this reckoning.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and maybe just to put a cap on this Sutton article, you know, he points out that like these historiographies want to include this wide, like the American virtues of the 18th, 19th century, Like basically the Great Awakening sort of stirred up and evangelicals were sort of carrying the American promise, right? But then there's this huge disconnect between that, the Civil War, and like American fundamentalists in the early 20th century who were not carrying the American whatever. They were ostracized and marginalized and excluded. Right, from power. They were sectarian and angry and battling against modernity, et cetera, right?
Yeah.
So all these tensions and the telling of the story that don't make sense, don't add up, et cetera. But I just want to read like his sort of proposal. You know, as he traces like the rise of post-World War II white evangelicalism. And I think he points out rightly that it was this move that it was a reactionary movement against communism. It was funded by economic libertarians who created, invented ideologies or ideas around the free market and how the free market functions. There were people that hated the New Deal, hated the liberal consensus that was in place from the 40s to the 70s, that it was a segregated movement, that it wasn't black and white people together, that most evangelicals were not in support of the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. That they were against it, or they were white moderates that sat out of that. And then this is what he kind of says as like his concluding, like, what are evangelicals? He says, I argue that post-World War II evangelicalism is best defined as a white patriarchal, nationalistic, religious movement made up of Christians who seek power to transform American culture through conservative-leaning politics and free market economics. Contemporary evangelicalism is the direct descendant of early 20th century fundamentalism, North and South. Both movements are distinct from antebellum forms of Christianity, pre-Civil War forms of Christianity. There is no multi-century evangelical through line. So why this was helpful for me, Ben, is because your friend who is like a legitimate pro-life believer, that was me in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and so I put my stake in the Bebbington Quadrilateral.
Right.
And I was pointing out the heresies and the injustices and the unbiblical beliefs of what was becoming and emerging as MAGA.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I was doing it with people who told me they were conservative Christians / evangelicals that believed in the Bebbington Quadrilateral.
Mm-hmm.
And over and over and over and over again, it was rejected. Like dozens of times, hundreds of times. Just, and that was incongruous for me.
Yeah.
You know? How could you be mad at me for naming there's a heresy of Christian nationalism, for instance, that's gaining purchase in our identity group? And how could you be mad at me for naming that? Mm-hmm. Why am I a problem for saying there's this heresy that we should deal with?
Right.
Like, for instance, and there are dozens and dozens and dozens of examples like that. And after, I don't know, a few years of that, Ben, I was like, is there a better story to explain what I'm experiencing rather than just there's a collective psychosis?
Yeah.
You know, where everybody has completely lost their minds. That's, you know, the plausibility of that is low.
Right. And much, much more plausible is that is the through line, or there is a through line, or there's a deeper reason why MAGA resonates.
Yeah.
For a lot of these people who claim this heritage.
Yeah. So it was more plausible that everybody was acting according to who they were versus everybody overnight, millions of people were becoming something they weren't.
Right. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Which that then provokes the identity crisis, right? For you, for me, and I think for a lot of our listeners as well. The identity crisis is, wait,
I thought that, you know, like, I feel like my choices are, I can leave this thing, or I can just say, well, I guess I'm, you know, they know best, and I'll just go along with it, you know? Yeah. And I guess, you know, I guess this is what it means to be, you know what I mean? But I think, you know, that identity crisis comes when you take your own convictions seriously and say, wait a second, like, what's the story here? And, you know, is this story true? And yes, is this a place where I can thrive and grow and, you know, participate in, you know, being the church, being, you know, involved in the work of the kingdom with these people or not? Do I need to find somewhere else to be?
Yeah. And then maybe we can end here and turn to that next time. Because there was a choice, and one of the choices you hear often is like, just stay off of social media, stay out of the news. This is just focus on the gospel. And one of the ways that I think evangelicals who find that their identity group isn't who they thought they were, they just retreat into sort of an isolationist theological bubble.
Yeah, keep your head down. Just, you know, live out your convictions locally in your local church, or, you know, just leave your church and, you know, live it out by yourself.
Yes.
And just try to,
you know, don't explore roots or why this is happening. Just sort of like, just block it out. Right. And there's all kinds of reasons for that. And all of us have to navigate our complicated relationships to people and commitments and, staying alive, et cetera. So, but that's one option. Another option that people have is they just continue to kick against the goads. You know, they continue to shake their fist at the, they continue to try to bring change. Mm-hmm. Right. And that, you know, that was me for, I don't know, 5 to 10 years, I think. And then, another group of us, I feel like two things happened to me. One is I feel like what I thought evangelicalism was didn't exist. Mm-hmm. So I felt like evangelicalism left me. But also the evangelicalism that did exist didn't want me.
Yeah.
I felt like I had to leave evangelicalism.
Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't. Yeah, and I think that's. Yeah, we can maybe get into it more next time. But I think that's part of, like your phrase that it doesn't exist, like at. And I think what you mean there is like as a movement, as an identity marker that is like, the remnant doesn't exist. What exists is, individual sort of like. Basically what exists is this history that was told where they focus on individuals through this lens, but as a movement, as an identity marker, that kind of evangelicalism has never existed and does not exist.
Right, right. I don't mean there aren't people that don't take the Bible seriously.
Right, exactly.
Even people who would consider themselves MAGA and Christian nationalists probably would agree with the quadrilateral, convergentism, biblicism, crucicentrism, and activism. But by the way, one of the points Sutton makes is that quadrilateral is so broad, so vague, so general that most Christians in most places hold to it. So it's not a particular mark of evangelicals. The issue isn't that the evangelicals I left behind don't believe the quadrilateral.
Yeah.
The issue is that when push comes to shove, they're more committed to free market fundamentalism than they are to debt relief.
Right. Yeah, in terms of how that theology plays out. Right.
Some kind of communal jubilee where people's debts are released, where land is returned, is an anathema.
Yeah.
When it's something that Jesus preached and enacted in his ministry.
Yeah.
That's the issue. So the same person who says biblicism holds social, cultural, ethnic, gendered prejudices, biases, beliefs that contradict that. And when push comes to shove, they're unwilling to reckon with that contradiction in a way that brings alignment towards the Bible.
Yep.
Yeah.
That, I mean, that's what I mean by doesn't exist.
Yeah. Yeah. And that quadrilateral, for example, that quadrilateral is like, you can look at that, like the Book of Common Prayer that the Episcopal Church uses in the United States of America, like all of that's in there. Like yeah. the theology, like that quadrilateral fits fine into like Book of Common Prayer Episcopalianism in the United States. Yeah. It works. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It works. Just read the collects, read the liturgies, you know, read the ordination liturgies. Like it's the quadrilateral works there. And that church, the Episcopal Church, has never been thought of in that way by these historians as evangelical. No. But the quadrilateral, but it works, you know? So mm-hmm. it is super broad. Yeah, that's yeah. interesting.
All right. So maybe we end there and come back next time and talk more about the particular details of how I, like the things that fell into place of what, mm-hmm. how I came to see that the story I believed and told myself about who I was, that story was not true.
Yeah.
Man, what a identity crisis. And, yeah. you know, and this is why deconstruction is so disorienting, is because it is an existential yeah. identity crisis.
It's a story we've told about ourselves our whole lives that is being called into question. And yeah. it's super disorienting. It's very yeah. difficult to go through. It's yeah. It's very strange.
Yeah. Right. So we'll get more, get to that more next time. Yep. Listener, if you want to share questions, obviously this article has 21 pages. I barely touched on some things. Mm-hmm. I know I spoke quickly and generally about it. So if you have questions, please do 15, 20, 30 minutes, read the article. You can email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com, and mm-hmm. we'll return to this conversation next week.
Have fun, everybody. Peace.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast, and don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity community. It's free to join, and you can connect there with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith and spirituality and whatever else comes up. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sternke edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsternke.com. Finally, we would love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, you can go to gravitycommons.com/message and click the Start Recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.